Okay, so a comment that Arjendo made during dinner made me sort of emphasize the second slide. So not only will I mention Monica Linker, who is one of my collaborators and with the Paraval, who did some of this work with us, but I will also emphasize that I'm not at all against doing my part in the undergraduate education. Currently we have three students, Savan Carell, who will graduate next year, who is doing string theory. Nathan is just starting and will graduate in 2 years. Noah has his own mind. He's doing cosmology and graduating next year. And before that, we had also other students working with us on this. Now, I think some of the sort of Arjendo's comment perhaps comes from this fact that when we talk about undergraduate in research, one thing that I have often in mind is a comment that was made not by a physicist, but by a mathematician. Do you guys know about Grothendieck, Alexander Grothendieck? Does that ring a bell for some of you? So Grothendieck is perhaps, he still lives, and he is one of the gods in 20th century mathematics. And if he's not the god, he's just a notch below, and it's unclear who it is. And so that's just my introduction, so that you have a feel of who he is. And one comment that he made is about students in general. So he had a research position for 10 years, then went to the university, then gave that up and wanted, again, a research position. And what he said was, if you do work with students all the time, then the students will only ask simple questions. And sooner or later, you yourself will ask only simple questions. And that is why I liked what Bob said initially, I think the first day, that he sort of divides things up. There is work that he does with the students, and we discussed this, that there is work sort of associated with students, but that he's also doing other things. He thinks independently of student work. And so that is one pole, sort of. But there is another pole, and that is that with some of these students we have published papers. And so I've underlined Sean Underwood and Stephen Stewart and Savan, who has written papers with us. Now, if you go back, there is one actually name missing, and that sort of aggravates me to no end, which is Joseph Tyson. And so the other pole of this whole spiel here is that Joe came to me as a freshman. He was homeschooled, and so he had no formal education in this sense. All was homeschooled, and I grabbed him as a freshman, and I explained to him the project, I think, in a short afternoon session. And at the end of the day, during the evening, Joey sent the first numbers to me. So he understood the project, he wrote the program, and he brought me data on the same day. So this clearly will be the absolute simplest talk that you have heard in this whole workshop, because a freshman homeschool can understand what's going on in one session, right? I mean, it must be obvious and simple. Okay. So with this, let's start. But the goal is, in some sense, obvious, perhaps not so obvious how you start. And so in a unified theory, you don't only want to understand the interactions and the fundamental theory of the particles. You want to understand how space-time comes about. Obvious question. But it's not so obvious where you look. And so if you sort of, you have your own prejudices, your own guesses. And so I have some options there, and you might disagree with some of them, and then you go off and you do something else, that's okay. But if you want to have a unified theory, then for me, at this point, it leads to string theory, if you want to unify all interactions. But this will not be a spiel here about
sort of the virtues or difficulties of this, so we'll do string theory.
Now, even if you say string theory is okay, I can live with that, then the way string theory has been done so far, it has absolutely no sort of guide what to do. Because what you do here is usually you take a string which has some length parameterized by some interval, and it ticks on, so there is a time parameter. And then you embed this into some space-time. And so the string is propagating in some space-time, and all you can do is, in some sense, give constraints. So you think of X as some kind of manifold, which is 10-dimensional, and then you ask for consistency requirements rather than construction of space-time. And so the consistency comes from the usual things. You want to have symmetries, and symmetries you want to have for unitarity. And so that's like in the standard model. And this has been successful. You can do interesting things with this simple question. Namely, you can find constraints for the nature of space-time, and there is a certain class of manifolds that's allowed, which is called Calabi-Yau, but all it is really is a curvature constraint. Some tricky curvature constraint, but that's all it is, just a curvature. And it does something interesting that was stunning in the 80s when these people did this, namely the topology of the Calabi-Yau, of the manifold, tells you something about the particle spectrum that you see in four dimensions. And so people have called this an explanation, and you may sort of question that it's an explanation, but it is a link. And that is something that in Kaluza-Klein, even before string theory, people have been sort of trying to do, and they failed to do this. And string theory allows you to do that. So topology, geometry, in some sense, is encoding the particle spectrum. And one way to do this, if you have seen this, then it will tell you something. If not, it doesn't really matter much because I'm not going to do anything with it. So one of these quantities is the Euler number. And these things here are sort of cohomology groups, and one can play this a little bit more. Don knows this. But they're Hodge structure. And so they are sort of a fine structure. This measures the HPQ. Think of these as some kind of measure of the fine structure of the topology of the manifold. So they are actual numbers that you can associate. It's nothing vague. But as I sort of emphasize here, it's sort of it's assuming a space-time or a class of space-times. Like it needs to have a metric, for example. And you put this in by hand. What you really want is to go away from this. And it's even difficult to illustrate what you want. And so I've been envious all workshop long about these nifty pictures that you guys have. I have very few of this. But one of them that I stole was this one. And so this here is an illustration of a string network, right? And so that should be our starting point. Even this is cheating, right? Because this is obviously embedded in something. And so you don't really want to think in terms of this. But this is one illustration. So this, you think of this as the string world network, and everything should follow from this. And so another picture that I stole is the other pole, which is this. I'm not really sure what this is supposed to mean, but in Brian Greene's book, it's an illustration for a Calabi-Yau. And it's not totally a lie, because here is actually, now I'm going to show you a model of a Calabi-Yau. Think of what this is, right? A model of a six-dimensional manifold. Huh. And it's this. Now what this is a projection, of course. So the trick is you have some kind of Calabi-Yau. You can write down the equation for this, very concrete. Undergraduate can understand this. But then you project it down to three-dimensional space, and this is what it looks like. So that is the final picture. I have nothing more to offer. So if you're waiting for pictures, yeah, out of luck. Okay. So the question then is, how do we start? How can we possibly start this construction game that I've raised here? And one of the important ingredients of string theory, actually is an indicator of what one should do. And what it is the symmetry. So I mentioned symmetry is important in order to have unitarity, to have a consistent quantum string theory. And part of this symmetry is what's called modular invariance. Something very simple, 2x2 matrix, we are two-dimensional, it's good. So determinant is 1, but now we do something somewhat strange. We take a complex variable, and it's not the usual matrix multiplication, it's a quotient. And so you have this sort of fractional kind of transformation. And these ingredients here, the elements, are integers, not any of, not real numbers. And so this group here is finitely generated. So that is a good starting point. It's one of the crucial properties of string theory that makes this whole theory tick. But then you don't know how to go on. Actually, let me sort of hide this for a little bit. And you say, okay, I mean, people have known this for 30 years, and so you need sort of some new twist, right? If you want to use this as your starting point, there is, in, when did I start? Ten after? So I started 10 after. Okay. And so you need a new twist. And I'm not really sure how one comes up with these new twists. And so I will... And I'm also not sure what the best way is to explain it. So I will just explain sort of how it actually happened. And I mentioned before that I was a postdoc at some sort of weird institute in Bonn, which had these experimentalists, plenty of them. It's not weird. I mean, we're used to this. And the other thing was there is a famous math institute. And when I started there in 93, Wiles dropped a bombshell in mathematics, namely the proof of the Fermat conjecture. And so let me sort of mention the Fermat conjecture, which looks totally outrageous. Why anyone should bother, right, in this game of physics? This is so far removed. But there is actually a moral. First of all, I will use it, and second, there is a moral for physicists in this. And so the Fermat conjecture is this inane-looking statement that if you have some integer, then you can separate it into a pair of integers with the same exponent. And so we know Pythagoras. In fact, I just saw that this traces back quite a bit. And so this was for n equals 2, of course. And the statement that this is really the only case that works over the integers is Fermat's conjecture. Yes? Yes, yes. The product, I should have written that, the product. And this has a very nice long history, even if you sort of start with Fermat. And so tons of important mathematicians sort of took steps toward this until in June 93, Wiles produced an incorrect proof, which is not really very stunning because there are probably thousands of incorrect proofs. And people, I don't know, it would be interesting to know how many man years or person years were spent by disproving all this garbage that was produced. And so for a while, it looked like Wiles was just one of those lines, sort of long list of wrong proofs. However, he did interesting things. Even if that had been wrong, this would have been a spectacular result. And then he lived in total agony for more than a year, and then he could fix it. And so the question is, what's the moral? The moral is the following. Two things. First of all, notice the time scale. So this was in 1637, and then 350 plus years later, this came to an end. And in some sense, opened doors. And one of these doors we went through. And so physicists, I think, should learn from this, in particular particle physicists, because in particle physics, the idea is if something is not done after 10, 20 years, it's undoable. You cannot do it, just give up, right? These guys tell you
in some sense, what persistence is, right? We should learn something about persistence from these guys. I don't know. But, you know, this whining about, okay, it's been, whatever, 20 years now in XYZ, and it's still difficult. Well, you know, I mean, so what? And so the question is, why am I telling you this, other than that this is a nice moral, which wouldn't be sufficient justification? So the point is, in fact, that the way this was proven was by proving another conjecture. And so Fermat is totally boring still for physicists, as far as I can tell. But this one here is interesting, no matter how vague it is, right? It says that something, some geometry here, I'll explain in a second what that is modular. And modular is good, because string theory is modular. And so that is something that is tantalizing, to say the least. And it was tantalizing to me in the mid-90s, and then I got deflected, distracted by another bandwagon that was dualities in string theory. But when I sort of arrived at my first college, I thought, what is it that I should do? And I thought, you know, I could just as well do something where it wouldn't matter where I am, whether I'm at Harvard or Princeton or at that college. It doesn't matter because nobody is doing this. And so that was part of the motivation to go back to this. So let me sort of explain what modularity means here in this context where we're doing it. And so again, we have this group here. And basically what it is some function so that if you take its argument and you transform it with this, then you have a simple transformation law. So this is like a tensor in something. Think of a tensor, some complicated. It's not invariant, but it has a simple transformation. And so these things are called modular forms of weight W. Now it turns out that this group is a fairly largest group, which is finitely generated, but it's an infinite group, and it is too strong. And so one has to soften this up a little bit by saying that this element here is simply a multiple of n, where n is some integer and has a name. And it turns out that in this Shimura-Tanyama conjecture that this level n of this modular form has, in fact, a geometric meaning. So that's good. And so what's the other part? What's an elliptic curve? And an elliptic curve is simply a torus. And so you can take the simplest sort of childish construction here. You have this parallelogram, and then you identify these two sides, then you get a torus. Or you do this a little bit more usefully in terms of groups. So you have a lattice, and in this case, this would be a lattice point, a generator, and this up here as well. And then you quotient. But more generally, you want to have some kind of polynomial, and here is where sort of this nice thing comes in with students. Every student in high school understands what a polynomial is. And so elliptic curve is not so easy, Calabian is not so easy, but they are just a bunch of polynomials. And students can easily handle that. And so then what this means in more concrete terms is that for each elliptic curve, think just in general geometry, certain geometries, you can associate some modular form. And so that is the thing that makes this sort of into a possible project. You can ask, okay, can you, first of all, identify modular forms as string theoretic objects? And second, you can try to generalize this then to higher dimensions. You don't want just to do elliptic curves. If that's all you could do, then that would not be very exciting physically. And so, let me illustrate this. What is an easy way, a fairly easy way, to construct this for some classes. It's not general, but it illustrates the thing. And so this actually addresses here the difficult direction. You go from the world sheet, this string swept out surface, to a space-time geometry. That is really the most difficult question physically.
And so what you do is you could take a modular form. I'll address where this comes from in a little bit. And then what you do is you look at a differential form, which is something like a tangent vector. It's the dual of a tangent vector. So you think manifold, and the manifold is approximated by just some plane, and that's the tangent space. And this here is an element in that, what's actually called cotangent space, the dual of a tangent space. This here now is a geometric quantity, completely standard. And what it is in fact, if you sort of combine the transformation behavior of F and that of tau, or rather d tau, then this differential form is in fact invariant, does not change under this group. Hence, it goes down. So you can consider the sort of modified quotient, ignore this. It's sort of the upper half plane, complex half plane. This is just here for technical reasons. And so what you do is you quotient this out. And so you get a nice curve because the complex plane is too real dimensional. And one talks about curves because it's complex curve. That's what you do in algebraic geometry. So it's a real surface, but a complex curve. And so this object here now lives on the tangent space of this curve. And it turns out that for certain, and not all, but on occasion, these things are in fact elliptic. And so what has happened here is that you have taken a modular form, something sort of strange that lives on the world sheet, and you have transformed this, or you lifted this, to a geometric quantity, and you know exactly what this geometry is. And so that's the first success in an easy sort of visualizable context. That you can ask now is, first of all, this modular form, is this really something that we can derive or get from string theory? Is this a string theoretic modular form? And then sort of could you generalize this? And so an example here that I'll sort of consider in more detail is, is for N is 27, you go the spiel, and all this is not so important. What I was just, why is this here? Here we go. Yeah, I missed that one. Right. And so it turns out that for n equals 27, you can easily write this down in a very explicit way. There's some specific thing. The details here are not really important. It's just sort of to show that this can easily be done, and it is very explicit, not complicated. And it turns out that if you take this particular modular form, then you get this curve that I started with as an illustration. And so now the question is, okay, if this nicely works, can you find this in string theory? And that's pretty ugly. What's important is that there is a factorization, and this factor here has a string theoretic, and again, it's not so important sort of what this means here, what these words mean. It is important that this is very explicit and that students can compute with this. And these functions, that's the other part of the story for the two dimensions among you, quote unquote, is if you look at this, then you can massage this into something that is called a string function, the CKLM. And part is these are building blocks in characters, and you can construct a partition function of this two-dimensional string theory from these things. Couple minutes. And so this was really the main thing. I'm sort of happy that I got to this point without rushing too much. Because it does address this important question, how you go from the world sheet to the geometry. And at this point, we can do this for more general things. Initially, we could just do this for the elliptic curve. And so the question then is, okay, how do you generalize the engine? Can you sort of crank a machine that would produce forms? And that is, the answer is no at this point. It is, after Wiles in particular, a huge field of mathematic algebraic geometry, and these are really, really difficult questions, but I don't tell my students that. And then there is a question that physicists would have. So this is a purely mathematical question. Physicists would want to answer that, and I have absolutely no clue about this. And so all this, in some sense, is experimental. And let me sort of actually perhaps stop here, because it wouldn't be fun to rush through all of this. The obvious question now is to go back, right, to have the other direction. Can you sort of can you answer this question, whether you go from geometry to the theory on the world sheet? And that uses completely different methods and uses these methods from number theory. And so I was trying to focus first on those, on that interesting and doesn't use these weird methods. And so the direction is doable, but it is complicated and it uses this number theory. So let me just stop here. This is a good point to stop.